Okay, we're going to get started with the next topic for discussion, which covers the communication requirements related to interim reviews. Under the current requirements in an interim review, an auditor should determine if any of the matters described by AU Section 380 as they relate to the interim financial information have been identified. If matters are identified, they should be communicated to the audit committee by the auditor or by management. In consideration of the importance shareholders place on interim financial statements, the board is considering whether these requirements should be enhanced, and if so, how. With that, our next discussion question is, are the current audit committee communication requirements for interim reviews effective? What additional communication requirements would be beneficial to audit committees? And it might help, I guess, tee up the question if anyone wants to share the types of communications they do see on an interim basis or that they share with clients on an interim basis. Liz?
Since nobody else wanted to say anything, we sort of do a mini version of year-end where we provide a letter going through significant estimates and quality of the application of the accounting principles. So it's maybe a quicker process, but we indicate if we had found any deficiencies during our quarterly review or any of our internal control work or interim work or anything like that. So our firm's policy is to have a formal discussion similar to that which you have at year end, but clearly only based upon a review process as opposed to an audit process, so that we bring things to the audit committee timely in the event that something needs to be changed, fixed, resolved prior to 12/31.
So based upon that, I'm gathering that some of the communications that were on that page we looked at before around significant judgments and estimates, I think probably feedback is coming out of your data. significant judgments and estimates, to the extent there's something important as part of the quarterly review, you'd say you'd discuss that with the audit committee as part of reviewing the interim results. And I gather also, would you be sharing with the committee whether or not you felt there were any material modifications that needed to be made to the interim financial information being filed with the SEC?
Absolutely. Depending upon which quarter it is, the amount of work that you're doing might vary. For example, the closer you get to year end, you might be doing some interim procedures during that quarter at the same time. So the amount of information you might have on hand to talk about is going to vary at the same time. But we would absolutely be talking about anything that we think would reflect on your end or needed to be changed in the queue or disclosures that needed to be improved, for example. And we may not say they must be improved in this quarter, but we might indicate that we would expect to see improvement in this disclosure next quarter to get you to a certain threshold or level by year end, those kinds of things. For accelerated filers, we might be talking about 404 and their identification of significant accounts. We might start to see growth in a particular account during the year, and we might indicate to them that they need to consider including that account in their significant accounts for examination under 404. So it's a wide variety of things that you would discuss, but we have a reporting section in our work papers where we would include that correspondence. But again, just like our last conversation, if you look at my work papers, it's going to look pretty boilerplate. But the discussions are not boilerplate. But the work papers would probably look that way.
Work papers would look compliant with the requirements. The discussions would be robust, you're saying. Thanks. Wayne, I thought your card was up. You thought about it and changed your mind? Or?
Well, it wasn't much to add beyond what Liz had mentioned. It's more of an updating process, much like the 10Q itself is an updating process in terms of disclosures. So anything that comes up in those particular areas that are based on, that we see based on a limited procedures that we perform, we bring to the audit committee's attention. But there are formal meetings set up to provide that mechanism for a dialogue.
Liz?
We also take that time as an opportunity to discuss what's coming, because at least lately there's been a lot of March 31 or June 30 effective dates and 9/30 effective dates, so we've sort of used that opportunity in the prior Q discussion to talk about things that are going to be happening next quarter and things that the audit committee needs to be paying attention to next quarter because they're going to be changing. So,
although the it's not fully contemplated in this question, but I thought I would just pose this question. There's the opportunity for auditors to issue written review reports as part of interim reviews. I tend to observe that I don't think that's happening very often. I was wondering if the auditors would be willing to comment if that observation was correct, that formal quarterly review reports were or were not being issued often, and if not, why you might think the committee, audit committees, might not want a review report if that's the case. Randy Fletchell?
Marty, I can answer the first part of the question. I haven't looked recently, but we did a few years back, and it's a very distinct minority of our SEC registrants that request that we issue a review report. The procedures are performed. I think it's just been one of those things that no one has really made a big deal of in the past. And so, I can remember when I go back years ago, we might have issued 100 out of more than 1,000 registrants, so it was pretty few.
Sam.
I think our experience is similar to Randy's. There's actually three buckets. There's the report that gets submitted with the 10Q. There's our times when we issue a report, but it only goes to the audit committee, and then there's times when we don't issue a report at all, just provide the company with clearance that we don't have anything that causes them to have to make some disclosure in their 10Q about the effect of our review, because, as you know, the review is assumed when you file the 10Q. I can't speak to why audit committees fall into any of those three buckets. It could be that the communication on an interim basis with the auditors is so effective that they don't think they need a report. It's somewhat said in jest, but I don't know the answer to the second question right now.
We don't have Lynn as, maybe we have a couple of audit committee members here. I don't know if they'd like to comment on that, or Larry or Jamie from your organizations, whether or not the audit committees have, you know, to necessarily speak about your organizations, but any perception on this in terms of audit committees looking for written reports or not, or whether they're perfectly happy getting the fact that an oral commentary and discussion of the issues, and the fact that the auditor says they don't have any material modifications orally, that seems to be satisfactory.
Marty, that's at least my perception, is that the value that the audit committee gets is from the verbal communication, the clearance, and the discussion of the issues. And obviously, the only thing that's really embedded in the report is the clearance, because it doesn't discuss any of the issues that might have been raised, so that they're going to want to hear more. So I think the report itself is really more, if you want to refer to the report, then obviously you need it to, because I think once you refer to it in a 10Q, you would have to include it. So I think just years ago, a number of companies decided to stop referring to the report to, so that they could not go through that formal issuance, because it's going to go into a drawer someplace and really doesn't have to get published anyplace.
So, Jamie, thanks.
I would just echo Larry's comments.
Right. So, the discussions are substantive and robust, and that seems to be the more important thing to the committee then, rather than a formal written report. Thanks for those comments.
Okay, let's move along to our last topic for discussion on this issue today. In light of the Audit Committee's responsibility for appointing, retaining, and overseeing the independent auditor, the board may consider adding communication requirements for auditors to discuss information on the firm and engagement leadership. Prior to the appointment of the auditor, audit committees often require auditors as part of the proposal process to provide information about the firm and the firm's internal quality control systems. In addition, for issuers on the New York Stock Exchange, the exchange requires audit committees to at least annually, among other things, obtain and review a report by the independent auditor describing the firm's internal quality control procedures. The ISA on communication with those charged with governance requires auditors to communicate the related safeguards that have been applied to eliminate identified threats to independence. The board could consider including requirements to include engagement level and firm level efforts to assure compliance with SEC and PCAOB auditor independence rules and principles, significant litigation against the firm or disciplinary actions against the firm or the engagement partner, and the reasons for changes, if any, in engagement leadership. So the next question is, should the board consider requiring the auditor to provide information about the firm and engagement leadership that would assist the audit committee in overseeing the auditor? If so, what type of information would be beneficial to audit committees? Galen Hansen?
I think this is a good question. I think the things that are in the briefing paper are appropriate. I also believe that an update on inspection status, I think that's come out and been discussed during a meeting already, and where that stands and the cycle that the firm is in with that, and also the quality control standards that the firm has adopted would be the types of things that I would expect to see here, and sort of a status update on what the firm is doing. And here again, who from the firm is being assigned, and sort of an annual update with the audit committee on who's doing what and any changes that have taken place.
Galen, is the discussion on inspection status really a function of the particular audit committee, the extent to which one audit committee is interested in inspection status versus another?
I'm not sure that I understand your question, Marty. You mean it would only relate to the particular engagement, an inspection comment, or no, or what?
No, the comment was inspection status discussed at all engagements, or is it a discussion really driven by the level of firm-wide inspection status?
I would look at
it. It's a function of the audit committee's desire to get more information about that.
Yeah, I would look at it as being all engagements, just a summary of where they stand. Where have they been inspected that year? What's their status with respect to the response? Have they remediated? Are there any outstanding issues with the PCOB?
Thank you.
Thank you for your input on this issue.
Arnold Schilder.
Yeah, may I just come back on an earlier discussion, a point that Liz again here raised when we were discussing the first questions, because we are struggling with the fact how can you address the audit committees, whereas it's not, of course, in our mandate. So also the IAASB has been wrestling with that. And there's one quote in the application material of ISA 260 that is in the line, I think, that Liz suggested. Let me just read it out. It's application material, paragraph A43. As noted in paragraph 4, effective two-way communications assists both the auditor and those charged with governance. Further, ISA 315, which is the risk assessment standard, identifies participation by those charged with governance, including their interaction with internal audit, if any, and external auditors, as an element of the entity's control environment. Inadequate two-way communication may indicate an unsatisfactory control environment and influence the auditor's assessment of the risk of material misstatements. There's also a risk the auditor may not have obtained sufficient appropriate audit evidence to form an opinion on the financial statements. So I think that at least might be a bit helpful, and if you are reviewing the risk assessment exposure drafts, Marty, maybe this is something that can be of some help somewhere.
It will be. Good. Thank you very much. All right, I think as... I'm sorry, was there another comment?
Yeah, I would make one additional comment to the three bullets in the discussion paper, which is in addition to the firm-wide discussion of the PCAOB inspection results, I think it would be highly relevant for the audit committee to understand if the company's engagement had been selected, and if so, what were the results of that inspection and any related comments or remedial audit procedures that were required.
Good. Thank you. All right. Well, thanks for all of the input on the subject of communications with audit committees. I think we heard a lot of commentary that to a large extent the communications are working well in many places. In a number of areas we heard primarily around, I think, qualitative disclosure. Auditors' assessments of the quality of the disclosures was maybe one area that seemed to have a strong consensus that that could be pursued as further addition to the auditing standard, but heard a lot of comments that basically indicated that they thought the communication process was working pretty well. Whether it was because of the standard or because it was just working well, that seemed to be a pretty strong theme. The next subject, and the final one, as we're coming down the home stretch, deals with related parties and our standard-setting project in that area. And Brian DeGano, Associate Chief Auditor, will lead that discussion. Brian?
Thanks, Marty. As Marty said, the purpose of our discussion today is to obtain some feedback that will help to inform our standard-setting project on related parties. And there are several topics that we'd like to discuss today. They've all been introduced in the briefing paper. The SAG previously discussed the topic of related parties at its September 2004 and June 2007 meetings. And at those meetings, SAG members were supportive of the need to improve the existing direction for related parties. The current standard was last updated in 1983. Since then, financial relationships with related parties were a contributing factor in several corporate scandals that resulted in substantial shareholder losses. As well, since then, in 2006, the SEC strengthened its disclosure requirements regarding executive compensation and related persons, and the IAASB has issued a revised standard on auditing related parties. And the AICPA's Auditing Standards Board is also looking at its literature right now. Information obtained from the board's inspection reports and enforcement actions have indicated that some auditors might still not be exercising sufficient professional skepticism when evaluating financial relationships and transactions with related parties. The board is currently considering all of these developments, and we're looking for more input from the SAG to help inform our standard-setting efforts. The first discussion topic that we'd like to discuss with everybody is assessing the risk associated with related party transactions. Currently existing PCAOB standards highlight the importance of exercising professional skepticism when evaluating related party transactions. They note that auditors should be aware of the possibility that transactions with related parties may have been motivated by conditions such as an urgent desire for a continued favorable earnings record in the hope of supporting the price of the company's stock. Those conditions are similar to the examples of fraud risk factors contained in the existing direction on the consideration of fraud. That fraud guidance also includes examples of fraud risk factors that are relevant to related parties, and that can assist the auditor in identifying the risk of material misstatement due to fraud, that is, a fraud risk. The staff wants to explore with the SAG how a standard could better improve the application of professional skepticism by auditors. The staff is currently considering making a recommendation that a proposed standard could include a requirement that auditors presume, under certain conditions, that some related party transactions are fraud risks. And this will bring us to our first series of questions. And I'm going to introduce these two questions together in the interest of time. The first question is, should a proposed standard require that the auditor presume that the following are fraud risks? A significant related party transaction that is outside the ordinary course of business, a significant transaction with a company that is a related party that is not audited, the creation of a VIE in which the company's economic interest is disproportionately greater than the company's stated power, the existence of a dominant influence being exerted by a related party. And the follow-up question, question number two, is really a build-on question to that, which is, are there other relationships or related party transactions or conditions that should ordinarily be presumed to be a fraud risk? And in general, what we're really seeking here is feedback on how could a proposed standard indicate to auditors that there should be special attention associated with related party relationships and transactions, and therefore improve the application of professional skepticism by auditors. And with that, I'll open it up to the SAG for discussion.
Arnold Schilder.
Well, in the interest of time, we had yesterday afternoon and this morning, I thought, a very constructive discussion on the fraud risk connotation in another context. I feel exactly the same feelings, that I fully understand why there can be very significant risks here, and I also would fully agree that special attention need to be paid to that, so raising the antenna, etc. But for all the reasons mentioned yesterday and this morning, I would not find it very helpful to label it as a fraud risk. And let me not repeat all the arguments, but yes, to state that.
Joe Carcel.
Again, this is preliminary, and so I wouldn't. We really need to wait to finish. But on a preliminary basis, the work we're doing on fraud over the last 10 years looks like there's a meaningful difference between fraud companies and no fraud companies and related party transactions. So once we finalize that, if that finding holds, I think you should consider that. That is a little bit different than the fair value discussion we had yesterday. One of the concerns I had with the fair value discussion in terms of labeling it fraud risk is that at least so far, now things may be different in the future given the direction of accounting standards, there haven't been a significant number of frauds where fair value was the driver of the fraud. Compare that with revenue, where that's overwhelming where it is. Related party transactions is somewhere between those two endpoints. And so you'd need to look at that. One of the things we haven't done, but we could do going forward since we'll have the data, is to try to link the nature of the related party transaction to whether that's the causative agent of the fraud. We're just comparing disclosures of related parties for fraud companies, disclosures of related parties for no fraud companies, okay? Not whether the related party transaction itself is the causative agent. So with that said, I think it's an important area. I do think the board should try to, when they're working on a standard, to tailor the standard in such a way that it's tailored to the types of parties and the types of transactions where fraud is more likely to exist. I don't think all related party transactions, in terms of who they're with and the nature of them, are created equal. And then to just label them as if they're some sort of monolith is probably not helpful and may create unnecessary work with no real benefit.
Paul Sobel.
Well, it can't be quite as brief as Greg Jonas, but my response is really ditto. Again, I think we covered it very effectively yesterday afternoon and this morning, and I believe those reasons apply. I think the information that Joe's talking about will be interesting once the research is completed, but I still believe all of the very valid reasons that were discussed this morning for not presuming it's a fraud risk apply here as well.
Just to follow up on that, Paul and Arnold and Joe, would you consider it a significant risk?
Yeah.
General agreement then on that? Bob Daisy.
Ditto the same as well. I wanted to follow on with that. I'm not sure I'd call it automatically a significant risk because not every single related party transaction necessarily rises to that level. So I think there should be some auditor judgment exercised. But I do think at the same time for related party transactions, there ought to be an assessment of whether it's a significant risk and whether there are fraud risk factors present. So I think some positive requirements to make that determination would be appropriate, but I would be concerned about automatic or presumptive placement as a fraud risk or significant risk.
Thanks, Bob. Let's go to Doug Anderson.
I guess I'll be the contrarian on part of this. I thought about the discussion we had yesterday afternoon and this morning and in this one, and I guess I'm more likely to think that the issues you're going to have with related party transactions are more likely to be fraud risks and not just significant risks. And one of the things I was going to take issue with is outside the ordinary course of business. I don't know if I would limit it to that. I mean, you could have a transaction that's kind of an ordinary transaction, if you will, but because it's with a related party, it's actually a fraudulent transaction. You have much more risk of that. And I do agree with the comments that not everything with related parties is a risk. Right? You could have some real simple things that are not a risk. You do have to understand the nature of transaction. But as I think about the kinds of transactions related parties that will be a problem, you know what? A lot of them would be very high fraud risks and not just significant risks. And so I tend to lean much more towards calling these more likely to be fraud risks than just significant risks, because that's really what as I think about what they would be, that's what I think they're going to often turn up looking like. And that's what you're going to be worried about, intentional desire by management to misstate and using a vehicle of a related party transaction that doesn't get the kind of scrutiny or have the independence you would with other parties. That's kind of what a fraud is. You know, that's the components of it, and related party transactions seem to lend themselves to that. So I more look at the nature of the transaction to make sure it is a risk, but it's probably going to be a fraud risk.
Wayne Collins?
And looking at the first one in terms of the related party transaction outside the ordinary course of business, the ISA 315 does mention that as a significant risk, which I agree with, but not necessarily a fraud risk. It doesn't say that, but not necessarily a fraud risk, which I think is a decision you come to based on an iterative process, based on evidence gathering, and in terms of your risk of material misstatement. And if enough evidence is brought to bear that indicates suspicion as to a fraud risk, that's the conclusion the auditor would come to at that time.
Thank you, Wayne. Greg Jonas?
Well, personal confession that'll betray my bias here. I've been burned too many times by these damn related party transactions. And I take Joe's observation that statistics show that these kinds of transactions are often, maybe not as often as revenue recognition, but they're often tools for fraud. And also, they often can be the tip of the iceberg. The transaction itself may not be fraudulent, but it betrays a certain attitude of management often that suggests that maybe that attitude has manifested itself in other places. And you want to look hard to make sure you understand whether you're really dealing with the tip of the iceberg. So I argued yesterday, as did the majority of others, that the measurement uncertainty for fair value was not a fraud risk, shouldn't be presumed to be a fraud risk for all the reasons we've discussed. But this one I would elevate to that level. And again, personal bias based on personal experience, but these things are cancer in my view.
Ted White?
I have to say, when I first went over the material, I liked this concept. And listening to the conversation here, it's helped me focus a little bit more on what it is I like about it. And I understand that the word fraud has caused some consternation because it's a strong word in the previous conversation as well as in this context. What I like about it and what I would suggest you emphasize is the heightened level of sensitivity from these situations, and whether you call it fraud or not, doesn't really bother me as much, as long as I know that it is a red flag indicator to where you are going to direct the auditor to do some more work. And even on the fair value assumptions, I think I would say the same thing there, although I understand that it's, you know, less of a statistical fraud risk. But the heightened level of sensitivity is what interests me.
Paul Sobel?
Just to follow up on what Greg Jonas mentioned. You know, Greg, I wholeheartedly understand and agree with your assessment, although I believe that what you were talking about, which is the tip of the iceberg, would more likely come out as a part of your fraud risk assessment, which is outside of this particular standard. And I believe what we're focusing on here would be individual transactions, and I continue to believe that an individual transaction by itself should not be presumed to be a fraud risk.
And Steve Rafferty.
My reaction to reading this was initially much like Ted's, in that I thought maybe identifying this as a fraud risk would be a good idea. From this standpoint, I think there are many auditors, particularly young auditors, that look at related party transactions as primarily a disclosure issue. So once you've identified it, you disclose it, you're there. And I think it's identifying it as a fraud risk sort of focuses on go audit it as well as disclose it. And but having sat here and thought about the whole notion of fraud risk, I kind of gravitate away from that and say, no, I don't think it is presumptively a fraud risk, but it is a significant risk and one that we need to call auditors' attention to and say, go audit it as well as worrying about the disclosure issue here.
Ted White. Ted, do you still have your... Ted, okay, and Larry Salva.
So just to weigh in, you know, behind some others, seems to me that there's two issues. One is, you know, do you label it as fraud risk versus significant risk? And then the other issue is it a presumption or is it a consider? And I tend to lean towards not presuming that it's fraud, but in the first instance, for the unusual transactions or outside the ordinary course of business, to put that into the category of presume that that is a significant risk, and then all other related party transactions ought to be considered or evaluated for whether they also represent significant risks, depending on their nature and understanding, you know, their use within the entity.
Doug Anderson?
Just one other little point. On the second bullet point on this number one, I don't know whether the related party having been audited or not makes any difference. How the issuer or my company accounts for the transaction is really not correlated with whether the other side of the transaction was audited, because they could account for it right and we could account for it wrong. So I don't think that qualifier has any impact.
You want to give any color on that, Brian, as to why we decided to put that point up there at the auditing?
The concern there is sometimes you may have a related party that's not audited at all, and in those cases the auditor may need to go do procedures there, but without doing a full audit they may not be able to get all the information they need in order to fully understand the transaction, or they may not even be able to get access to the business records that they really need. That was kind of the thought process, that it happens in some situations.
Yeah, but I understand your point.
Yeah.
There.
Greg Jonas.
I share the staff's enthusiasm for this point. Again, part of being personally burned on these transactions was involving this as well, where with hindsight, management intended for the other entity not to be audited or audited by different auditors, so that no single auditor saw the whole picture. And that was part of the importance of structuring these transactions, and I don't know, it just warning sign wanted to go up. I put my card up, though, because I wanted to follow up on a point that Paul made to make sure, because Paul might get to the answer I'd like, but for a different and better reason. So let me just see. I think, Paul, I heard you say that look, Greg, when I'm looking at these as individual transactions, don't be talking to me about fraud. But when I put my fraud risk hat on in connection with that audit standard, I'm going to be considering these transactions together with other fraud risk indicators in designing fraud-specific procedures. If you were to do that, could you imagine a situation where if you saw these kinds of related party transactions, that you would not be targeting fraud-specific procedures at these transactions? Right. So I would be very happy with Paul's answer. His justification for that answer, he's smarter than I am, he would do it through the fraud standard, and he gets to the same answer as I would by ticking these individual transactions as having fraud risks. So if everyone were to concur with Paul's view, then I'm relaxed about asserting these transactions have fraud risks. But if others get different answers than Paul when they put their fraud risk hat on, then I'd like to label these dogs fraud risk too. A little piling on.
Damon Silvers.
I agree with this, the thrust of this initiative, and I wanted to give the staff a little bit of a legal context for it, which perhaps you're aware of, but it might be useful background for you. As a general matter, the corporate law doesn't really allow investors to challenge transactions. If they're very large, of course, there's a process for valuation and so forth. But ordinary business transactions is ordinary business. You can't go into court. Related party transactions is another thing entirely. In fact, the whole law of fiduciary duty kind of amounts to a law of related party transactions in the corporate context. That and voting is pretty much what enforceable fiduciary duties turn into. I think that embodies a recognition on the part of certainly the courts and the legislature in Delaware that this is an area of unique vulnerability where the routine instruments of corporate governance and corporate functioning are under great and unusual pressure. I think that is essentially the insight you are trying to embody here, and I think it's well. I think other people have seen that in other contexts and have acted accordingly. It's in a way it's sort of surprising that this is a matter you have to take on that hasn't been addressed before. I would also say that I think that like our discussion yesterday, there's a range of conduct here that would be troubling from the perspective of having a sound audit. It's not all exclusively acts that could be proven in retrospect to be fraud, and that the standard that you might want to do here would be one that would try to capture for the benefit of auditors the range of things they ought to be looking for. Again, I think though that the impulse here is spot on and is hardly a radical idea in view of the fact that really our whole legal structure recognizes that this is a particularly questionable area. And I would further say that, and I think this is kind of the sort of thing that Greg was alluding to, that my own experience in a whole bunch of different settings is that it is... Related party transactions are almost never what they seem to be. I mean and particularly in hindsight, they're never what they seem to be.
In light of the list up there, the four bullets, are there any other
related parties or related party transactions that we should consider, more in line with question number two. Any other items that we should consider in addition to what you saw on the previous slide, those four bullets? Galen Hansen?
I was just going to say, as I was going through these materials, it struck me that these site agreements that we see that have led to some fraudulent activities over the course of the years should come under some scrutiny, too. It seems to me that there's some elements that are connected there, and in fact they might be related party transactions that we just haven't labeled as related party transactions. So I would hope that at least that might be considered by the standard setting.
Thanks, Galen. We're going to have a further discussion in a few minutes about these other transactions, and I appreciate you bringing that up. Liz Gantner?
Yeah, my comment is along the same line as Galen. I was looking at your list and talking to Greg yesterday about it, and I said, if I can identify it as related party and out of the ordinary course of business, I'm sort of home free. It's those that I am unable to identify as a related party transaction or maybe even outside the ordinary course of business. And, you know, it's those that are not talked about in the minutes. It's those that are not fully documented such that the evidence I need to identify them as related parties. And so if you get to what to me would be presumed to be a fraud risk, it's the ones that they have failed to even identify. And that to me is the real challenge in the related party world.
Thank you, Liz. Greg Jonas?
The one I would add here, and we're going to talk more in depth about management-related parties here in a minute, I know, but transactions with management that are asserted to be outside of management compensation, so like loan transactions or management enters into a joint venture with the company or management owns the other side of the venture or a piece of the venture, you know, something's going on here, and it's just these things are, again, my bias, but they're cancer. They betray a certain attitude of management that I think is worthy of much closer scrutiny than perhaps we give them today until after we get burned. So I would add that one to the list.
Well, this has actually been some very good input and insights for us. One thing I would just like to throw out there, the last bullet on question number one talks about the existence of a dominant influence exerted by a related party. And I know some SAG members mentioned that there may be conditions that when you couple it with a related party might elevate it to a fraud risk. And I was wondering, beyond the belief that there might be a dominant influence or domination, something like that, are there other conditions that when coupled with, let's say, a related party transaction, that one might say, you know, that might kick it up into a fraud risk category? So something that could help to inform the auditor's judgment as to what are the red flags, if you will, when you start to couple these things together, that it elevates to a fraud risk.
Wayne Collins?
Well, you'll be dealing with one of those items shortly, I think. If you've got significant short-term incentives, where the transaction in question would have a significant influence over what that compensation happens to be, that coupled could certainly elevate it to closer to a fraud risk.
Jim Schnur?
Yeah, I think you just need to be careful around this. If you think of the way this is characterized, a transaction between a parent and a sub would meet this criteria. And there's a lot of transactions that happen between the parent and the subsidiary that are kind of more in the normal course of business. So I think you have to look at who the other related party is, what the nature of the transaction is, and other circumstances before you would jump to the conclusion that these are presumed to be fraud risks.
Thanks, Jim. Let's move on to our next topic on financial relationships with management.
management is a related party, and the financial relationships that a company has with its management can result in significant incentives or pressures to commit fraud. And, for example, management might be motivated to focus on increasing the company's stock price in the short term rather than working towards achieving longer business goals when their stock options vest in the upcoming period. And additionally, if management is borrowed heavily against the shares that it's owned, it might be pressured to achieve aggressive earnings targets. Obtaining a robust understanding of the company's financial relationships with management could assist the auditor in assessing the risk of material misstatement, and it could also inform the auditor's evaluation of misstatements at the end of the audit. The staff is looking to consider whether or not to recommend to include procedures in a proposed standard that could assist the auditor in determining whether and when the auditor should obtain such a robust understanding of management compensation and financial relationships with management. A proposed standard might describe procedures that the auditor could perform to obtain that understanding of financial relationships with management and how those relationships could result in incentives and pressures for management to commit fraud. And, for example, one procedure might be to require an auditor to obtain an understanding of the company's executive compensation arrangements by reviewing contracts and arrangements and agreements. And the next question that we wanted to go through with the SAG is whether a proposed standard should include a presumption that a financial relationship with management that creates a significant incentive for achievement of short-term performance goals could be presumed to be a fraud risk, and whether there's other ways in which a proposed standard could assist auditors in obtaining an understanding of financial relationships with management, that is, management compensation. In other words, what we're getting at here is how could a proposed standard identify those instances in which the auditor should obtain a robust understanding of how management compensation has been structured and how financial relationship with management could result in incentives and pressures to commit fraud, and thereby raise the auditor's level of professional skepticism when considering those. And open it up to the SAG for discussion.
Joe Carcello?
I guess in some sense, I would think auditors are already evaluating this now, right? Because on the SAS 99, there's the fraud triangle, and one of the three legs of the triangle is incentives and pressures. And in the discussion of incentives and pressures is, as I recall, a pretty good discussion about the incentives that are created by compensation plans and tied to meeting analyst expectations and so forth. So it's not immediately obvious to me why the auditor wouldn't be doing something of this nature already. Are you suggesting that your work in inspections indicates that it's insufficient, and so you're suggesting that they do more? I'm not sure where the question really emanates from.
Well, you're right. The standards already would expect an auditor to gain an understanding and to consider it. Where sometimes you run into differences, well, I would say differences in reasonable judgment is, what does it mean when we say gain an understanding? How much work do you have to do to say gain an understanding? Reasonable people can hear that phrase and say, well, I thought this was sufficient to gain an understanding. Other people might say, well, I would have expected to do more to gain an understanding. And the thought here is, beyond just telling auditors to gain an understanding, is there other information or other guidance or direction that we could provide in a proposed standard that would help to inform them when are the circumstances such that they really need to make sure that they understand this, not a high-level understanding, but have a good, robust understanding of how these financial relationships with management could result in incentives or pressures to commit fraud. And as well, what are the types of procedures that one would expect an auditor to do to obtain that understanding that reasonable people would look at and say, that those level of procedures, when performed, will result in a sufficient enough understanding to plan and execute the audit.
Ted White.
First off, I would say that there is a wealth of information in the remuneration plans at the executive level that much of which would help the auditors do their job. I would completely agree with that. I would suggest removing the emphasis on short-term performance goals so that you don't narrow the scope. I agree that you'll find those in short-term performance measures, but I think you may find more significant drivers in long-term aspects of compensation plans, and you don't want to be stuck in the terminology of short to long. And as far as procedures, whether you want to dictate this, you know, to the degree in which they have to go into each plan, but I would suggest that in some way you frame that the auditor should have a working knowledge of the mechanics of the compensation plan, including the the formula that may underlie it, the performance drivers and the implications from an accounting standpoint. So that they know which levers and which aspects of the business actually have the largest impact on the performance plan. But again, this is a qualitative type assessment. There is no way you're going to formulate something that's highly quantitative to understand how a compensation plan actually works and drives behavior.
Damon Silvers.
Perhaps I disagree with Ted. I'm not sure. I was going to sort of give you the opposite advice, but maybe it's not really the opposite advice. I think that Ted is correct in that you don't want to write a standard such that it suggests that long-term comp can't have these effects. I think that's correct. I think perhaps the question of what do we mean by short and long-term. My view and the view of an awful lot of people who've looked at this carefully is that there's some kind of distinction around economic cycles here. If a comp package allows you to cash out in general with, and this is particular to in financial firms, but not exclusively financial firms, if you can game a slice of the business cycle, that's a short-term plan. If you're locked in over the whole length of a business cycle, that you're getting more toward the long term. And depending on the nature of your business, it depends on what the real time horizons are. Very capital-intensive businesses with 10 and 15 and 20-year plays. That's comp packages should be reflective of that, those sorts of things in some fashion. The point I would want to make that may not be in agreement with Ted is I think there is a particular risk associated with shorter term plans. It's just easier to know what you're stealing, so to speak. And this set of risks, although not conceived of in audit terms, has been the subject now of a whole lot of commentary from the President of the United States, from Secretary Geithner, Paul Volcker. More recently, the Aspen Institute put out a set of documents that the AFL-CIO is signatory to, along with Warren Buffett and Pete Peterson and a lot of other unusual compatriots, really focused on these issues. And I think that the staff, again, in this area is right, is in exactly the right place with exactly the right set of concerns. And so I think you do want to have somewhere here an emphasis on the risks associated with particularly short-term plans. It should not, though, close off auditors to the fact that you can also play games with long-term plans and that they can be a pressure, they can be an incentive to fraud. I think what really matters is the notion that when you are looking at a transaction that where there's an executive pay structure that is arguably or likely to be dependent on that transaction, that is something you ought to be paying really close attention to.
Thanks, Damon. Steve Rafferty?
I think we may be focusing our attention on the easy part of the equation rather than the difficult part of the equation here. I think and I'd be interested to hear from the other auditors, but I think the easy thing is identifying the compensation arrangements. The hard part is finding the things that management might do to manipulate the financial statements to drive that compensation. I don't think this is probably the area where the standard ought to be focused. I think the assistance, if any, in improving audit quality is the other side of this.
Just to follow up on that, so I think that the idea is that having the short-term incentive could result in a fraud risk or could result in a heightened risk. and then the auditor needs to think about where that risk could manifest itself elsewhere in the financials. So, you know, what are the areas that are most likely to be subject, or if management was going to commit fraud, where would they do it, and then focus their attention there, right?
Yeah, I think auditors are probably doing a pretty reasonable job of this already, to say it a different way.
Just to follow up again, doing a good job of the first part, the second part, or both?
I think they're doing a good job of identifying the incentives that may be there. It's how management might accomplish a manipulation of the financial statements to drive that compensation that is the most challenging piece of this. But I think the auditors are generally aware of the compensation arrangements and how they work already. That would be my sense. That's not the hard part.
Sam Ranzilla.
Well, without quibbling whether the words short-term or long-term ought to be in there, I guess as I read it, is there any public company that wouldn't apply to?
It could scope in a lot.
I think if you mean in the 90 percentile, a lot, I'm with you. So do we want to have a presumption that 90-some percent of our public companies have a fraud risk because management has incentives for the achievement of performance goals? Short-term, long-term, doesn't matter. I think that's the slippery slope that we find ourselves getting into when we start writing presumptions like that. So, and to Steve's point, I quite frankly don't think this is in the right standard. I don't think this ought to be in a related party standard. This ought to be in your risk standards. Because this is, I think Steve was absolutely right. Let's call it a fraud risk. Just all walk out of here this afternoon and say, oh, we got that one. But it all comes down to response. I'm not. It's got nothing to do with management's compensation. The response. It's not. It's where it could lead you very well down a path of pretty much going to a forensic audit if you believe this. So I want to be pretty. I'd like for us to be careful as we go down this path.
Yeah, I understand your concern, and the thought here is to really draw out those characteristics, those things that the auditor should focus on, and try to get their attention focused in the right spot, and try to see if a standard can come up with a way to increase professional skepticism in certain circumstances. And you're right, it's not necessarily the compensation itself auditing that. It's where else that compensation may drive behavior, how something else may happen. But, you know, part of the idea of trying to come up with this or improve the auditor's application of professional skepticism when they look at related party transactions is trying to say, in a lot of cases, when you see where things have gone wrong, the auditors saw these things, but they usually, it ended up at the very end of the audit. There wasn't a lot of time to really sit back and critically analyze it. One goal of this would be, is there a way to try to get some of that information being looked at earlier so there's more time for an auditor to critically analyze it and think about it as opposed to getting it at the end of the audit where it's much more difficult to deal with it when they come up then. So these questions are trying to draw out those types of responses, those types of procedures. But yeah.
When I read this as the paper was put together in response to your comments, Sam, I was, and I agree with your point, that certainly most corporate America has financial arrangements that are based on performance. You know, pay for performance is the name of the game. It was the phrase in there that creates, maybe it wasn't put in there correctly, significant incentive for achievement of a short-term performance goal, i.e. where the incentive was so large and maybe so potentially even maybe disproportionate to the goal, but in any event, where the incentive was so large
that seemed to be outside the ordinary. Was how I was thinking of this when it was put together.
Well, Marty,
and again, so some of those were the type of incentives that I think were criticized in, you know, recent actions by the federal government and some of the plans they looked at.
When you read it, Marty, did you read significant from the perspective of the executive or from the company perspective?
Yeah, that's why I said the phrasing of this. I read it to be a financial relationship that with management that creates a significant incentive for compensation is how I was thinking of it.
Right, so to the individual.
To the individual.
So if I'm making $100,000 a year as a controller, and I have the right, based on some performance goals, to make another $100,000 of a bonus, I'd have to call that a significant incentive. I can tell you that if that were my case, that's significant to me. So I think this is going to scope in just about, some very large number of companies.
Yeah, I understand your point. Again, it was where the incentives seemed to be disproportionate in terms of if you're making a $500,000 as a CEO and the incentive was multi-million dollars if you achieve this performance, but that kind of thing, or the same thing for a trader.
Just as a follow-up, are there other, going along those lines with the $100,000 example, are there other conditions that one could look at when you have that type of a situation to try to say, okay, when is it, like, what are types of things that an auditor could consider if they're looking at incentive compensation to try to determine when is it significant? Are there best practices that are out there that we might be able to identify?
I'll take help here. Everybody's leaving the room. I'd have to think about that, but I think it's a very legitimate question, because what you're asking, Brian, is, okay, is it, how do we narrow it, right? And I think that's a very good objective. Just off the top of my head, I can't think of any, but maybe some of my counterparts can.
Thank you.
Greg Jonas?
I think this is a very important issue in an audit, maybe among the most important issues in an audit, but I think that we're misplacing it, to echo Sam's point, when we talk about it in the context of related parties. I think what we're talking about is the incentive. I share Joe's earlier comment, the incentive leg of the fraud risk triangle. In my experience, when thinking about the incentive leg, the question is, first part is, what are the hurdles, the incentive hurdles for management? And some of those hurdles are compensation. Other hurdles, though, are the covenants in the debt agreements, what the credit rating agencies might expect for the hurdles they've set, and what the market expects implicit in the current stock price. You first array what are the hurdles, and then you ask, where is the business, how is the business delivering against those hurdles? If the business is fully capable of delivering in those hurdles because business is good, then there is relatively little pressure in those circumstances, even though there are many hurdles to jump through, because the business is naturally jumping those hurdles in that business cycle. Everybody's got a grin on their face. Life is good and business is fun. The pressure comes where you've got the hurdles and the business in the normal course is not capable of meeting those hurdles. Now you've got pressure. And it's the combination of the huge incentives, not just compensation, the combination of incentives and an unnatural ability to meet them that now causes people to start to say, wait a minute, how do I move the report card so I give the illusion of meeting them? And they start stretching. There's where the danger is. And the beauty of this analysis, if you lay out all the hurdles and how short the business is coming in naturally being able to deliver against it, tells you where, if you're going to cook the books, you're going to cook them. And I think a lot of times, and I was guilty of this when I was in practice, for example, I didn't realize what, for example, the rating agencies were telling management were the hurdles. And management felt enormous pressure to meet certain financial targets that weren't written down in any agreements that the auditor could read. But yet management felt enormous heat to have to deliver against those targets, as one example. So I think you're onto something very important. I would focus attention on the incentive side of the fraud risk triangle, and I would think about it robustly rather than narrowly about compensation.
David Silvers.
I want to speak to the... Mike Gray's not on the table. I want to speak to the issue Sam raises about, you know, how are we encompassing... Are you potentially talking about encompassing everything and everyone in such a test? I think there's two ways to break out what you're looking at conceptually, and in writing a standard, you might wish to be explicit about this and to give some guidance as to how to understand it. A lot of performance compensation in American business today, at least in public companies, which is after all what we're talking about here, is obviously stock-driven. Accounting numbers don't set stock prices in a kind of one-to-one way, although obviously they influence them. If you're talking about stock-based compensation, I think the auditor probably needs to be aware as best as they can of those numbers, and they would tend to be aggregate numbers that a manager would likely feel would be driving, would have a direct impact on their compensation. And I think to Greg's point, some of this is not going to be obvious because of the role of intermediaries such as consensus analyst opinion or rating agencies. And in certain types of companies, the rating agency issue is going to be critical. Insurance companies and banks and so forth is, you know, maybe the total obsession of the management. But these types of issues, I think, would tend to run toward aggregate numbers where fraud issues may be somewhat, it may be rather hard to commit a simple fraud. And that may lead to a certain type of skepticism or a certain type of attitude by auditors in those circumstances. And then you have, I think, another set of considerations, which is the circumstance that may exist where an employee, not necessarily a CEO or a CFO, but an employee is being incented around about hitting a particular thing, a particular target of some kind, sales force, a trader, and the like. And I think there you're getting into looking, I think when that type of comp is constructed, particularly a short-term structure of that kind, there may be valid business reasons to do so, but you are building a structure that is really does have a deep, a profound kind of inherent fraud risk in it. And there really ought to be that kind of focus. I don't think that kind of thing necessarily implicates everyone and every institution in corporate America. What I just said, I don't think is a complete account of the way you want to think about this, but it's kind of a suggestion as to how to begin to think about narrowing and being more precise, so that this standard doesn't become everything and everyone, which I think would not be useful to anyone if it did.
Jamie Miller.
I just wanted to echo a couple of comments. You know, I tend to agree with Sam on this one, that we have the opportunity here to boil the ocean a bit. And maybe what we need to do when we think about this is take a step back and perhaps set the requirement at, you know, the auditors being required to obtain a sufficient understanding of the compensation practices of the firm and how those link to financial metrics or other, you know, metrics that could manifest themselves in the way of financial risks, and also obtain an understanding of the board and management kind of governance and oversight process. But I do worry that, you know, if we've got a company with 20,000 employees or 10,000 or 100,000 employees that we have the risk here of sending our auditors off on a wild goose chase without, as Steve so appropriately said, taking a step back and really giving the critical thought to how could any incentive incentivize behaviors or risks or, you know, companies to take on operating standards that are going to ultimately manifest themselves in the way of accounting risks or disclosure risks. So I totally agree with Steve that this really needs to be focused on that element of it, you know, obtaining enough understanding to size the risk, but then really focused on the planning and execution of the audit.
Thank you, Jamie. Wayne Collins?
Thank you. 2 points. One is the fraud triangle was mentioned a number of times. One of the legs in the fraud triangle is the opportunity, and the opportunity that will then cause you to focus on what are the controls regarding management override potential, and that really needs to be looked at in arriving at what the risk of material misstatement is. In terms of the boiling the ocean comment, I agree with that, and I think the standard needs to be written in the such that the auditor needs to evaluate the extent of the risk that he or she perceives based on the nature of the compensation agreement, because otherwise, you know, we're focusing on what the incentives are, like bonuses and so on. Just having a job for many people is an incentive, and keeping the job, and I think that's been proven in many fraud cases before, people that were involved in fraud. So we really need to be careful, because the ocean will become that much larger otherwise.
Well, Ted White.
So just to follow on from Damon's point, I suggested removing the word short-term more to broaden the scope, not to take the emphasis off short-term incentives. I fully agree that there can be clues both in the short-term and the long-term aspects in it. And in fact, in practice, I find a lot of cases the quote-unquote long-term programs that are defined in the proxy under the word long-term actually have annual measurements in them a lot of times that are exactly the same measurements as the short-term plan. So it was more just to make sure that those aren't ignored. And I agree with some of the comments that have just been made, that there are other drivers than just a strict financial. There are, you know, cultural and situational drivers that obviously are involved in fraud situations. But to reverse this question and somewhat to what Sam was after is that it seems to me that in almost all cases of fraud, there is a financial motive. And therefore, the compensation plan is going to be one of the common threads in most, if not all, of your fraud situations. So the reason I would suggest the focus on it is that it's likely to be involved in every situation, and it's probably where some of the breadcrumbs lie. That's not a certainty, but my assumption is there's lots of clues in there, and particularly when plans are narrowly focused on one or just a couple of drivers, when there are changes in plans, as well as just in whether frauds can be perpetrated to tailor to an existing comp plan. That's it.
Thanks, Ted. Jim Snur.
Thanks. Just three things. One was, I agree with the comments earlier that there really isn't a problem in looking at these arrangements and identifying, you know, whether there's an incentive or not. Second point is, I do think that, as somebody else said previously, the standards do address this issue in terms of, you know, evaluating risks. And maybe to Sam's point about trying to narrow it, this is only one factor that you have to consider in combination with other factors and circumstances, similar to what Greg Jonas said before about where are you in the business cycle. You need to look at, you know, for example, in combination, is the person that holds this position, are they in a dominant position, are they domineering, or, you know, what's the controls in place to prevent that person from getting in? So there's a lot of other factors that you have to consider before you would get to a point of where, you know, whether this is a fraud risk.
Thanks, Jim. Doug Anderson.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what has been said. I just wanted to focus on a couple things. One is, I mean, I understand there's a fraud risk and such, but this is the kind of risk that'll be pervasive everywhere. I think somebody mentioned earlier, you're going to end up as an auditor have to focus on the opportunity, not just this risk. You're going to have to figure out where this would work itself out. Because of that, I don't think it's a related party type standard. I think it really gets back into a fraud kind of standard. And it's something that can be developed, but it's really a fraud standard view, because this, you have to figure, the next step is an auditor, where do I go with this then? And that's what I think the fraud standards do, better than a related party standard.
Arnold Schilder?
Well, I just was going through exactly the same analysis, I think, as Doug just said, and I have here both the ISO fraud risk standards and the related parties. And this is a fraud risk factor out of many that are in the appendices to the fraud risk factor. And I know we discussed the issue yesterday as well, but listening to the conversation again, I arrived at the same point. There's so much that you have to consider from a fraud risk perspective that seems to make sense to have that in separate standards. And then you are dealing with the related parties, indeed, to focus on the risk analysis of very many special circumstances. And then at a certain point in time, of course, you have to decide whether you go to the fraud risk area or not. Just adding to that, many of these discussions, of course, have also taken place in the IAASB, and I have offered yesterday already if it would be helpful for staff to have an informal conversation with our staff to understand that, of course, by all means, we're willing to do that.
Thank you, Arno. Galen Hansen.
When we're talking, and I focus on the second half of the question here, the second part. When we're talking about related party transactions, there's basic, as we all know, a presumption of arm's length transactions, and that's where I have the greatest difficulty with related party transactions. And it seems like there's not only the accounting, but then the disclosure reporting part of this. And I wonder whether there's opportunities for reporting. And where I'm coming from is out in the Wild West, where we've got handshake deals and joint ventures, overriding royalty interests, all these different sort of our arrangements. You can't necessarily have that presumption of an arm's length transaction. So would this not, and I'm not getting into the disclosures under the FASB 57 requirement, but it seems to me that there's some auditor reporting disclosures that could be made when there are so many of these transactions that presumption may not hold true, that the underlying balance sheet and P&L elements may not hold up to scrutiny. So reporting, was there any discussion of the impact on the audit report as to whether that should be an informative, additional information type of disclosure?
Thank you, Gaten. That's something that we can certainly take and consider as we move down this road in this project. We'll certainly take that into consideration.
And I think this has been really good feedback and input, and I think we actually did touch on question four already, and I'd like to just kind of introduce that in question five together, and then if anyone has thoughts on either of these, open it up for the floor. First, question four is what types of procedures could auditors perform to obtain an understanding of the company's financial relationship with management? And question number five is, when evaluating the financial relationship with management, which individuals would be considered in the auditor scope? So is it persons in a financial reporting oversight role, senior management, or just management as defined by the applicable accounting framework? So with that, I'll open it up. If there's any additional thoughts on questions four or five.
Galen, is your card still open last time?
Yeah, and I think we did kind of touch on these two questions during the larger discussion on question three. So thanks for the input on this discussion topic. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Nick Grillo, who's going to lead us through our next topic.
Thank you. Existing direction notes that the auditor should consider the risk of possible undisclosed related party transactions and relationships and outlines procedures that the auditor might consider performing to address those risks. That direction allows the auditor's risk assessment to determine the extent of procedures performed to identify possible undisclosed related party transactions and relationships. However, an audit normally includes other procedures such as reading minutes of the board of directors and considering information obtained from legal and other external confirmations. Those procedures might assist in identifying undisclosed related party transactions and relationships. The existing direction provides examples of procedures for identifying material transactions with known related parties and identifying transactions that may be indicative of the existence of previously unidentified relationships. At previous SAG discussions, some SAG members noted that auditors should perform procedures to identify undisclosed related party transactions. However, other SAG members expressed concern that an auditing standard that requires auditors to identify undisclosed related party transactions might be too costly and burdensome. This brings us to our next question. Should a proposed standard require procedures that the auditor should perform to determine the existence of undisclosed related party transactions? If so, what procedures should be performed? With that, I'll open it up to the SAG. Damon Silvers?
If you'll indulge me, I'd like to... You move past five, four and five before I can get my hand up. I didn't want to interrupt you when you were in and I think these in certain ways are related in a sense. I think that, and I wanted to address five, and I think this then says something about six, actually. There are obviously people with power over the preparation of the financial statements as a whole. The CFO, the chief risk officer, I mean, there's a group of chief of internal audit. There are a group of people with an ability to shape those statements, and there are people who they answer to, CEO, COO, and so forth. And obviously those people need to be paid attention to. Then I think there's another set of people that you need to be aware of, and those are people who by nature of their the role they play in the firm are able to shape material transactions and shape the accounting treatment of material transactions. And I think one of you mentioned, you know, traders at some point. I think there are firms where such people are in that position. There might be a sales, some organizations, salespeople might be in that position, a particular sales managers. But so in some organizations, there really isn't anybody. They're not built in such a way that one individual can materially shape the financial statements or shape them with or where there's this connection between such a person's compensation and the statement and the shaping of financial statements. And I think that, again, that type of analysis is where an auditor ought to be guided toward. How do you find an undisclosed related party transaction? I think this kind of takes you toward, you know, back toward the forensic audit question. I have been involved at times in doing research in this type of area. There are, I think, consulting with some people who do sort of after-the-fact investigations might reveal that there are some examples of ways of looking for patterns that are not terribly labor-intensive that one could undertake. An example of something I'm aware of is that it's not that hard these days to figure out whether people own property in common, for example. That the firm owns property in common with an individual, and that tends to be kind of trivial stuff. But there may be a handful of sort of simple tests that could be undertaken that might pick up some things. But I think beyond that, you're asking us a rather difficult question.
I think. we tried to summarize that, like in previous meetings, SAG members had pointed out that, you know, it's difficult to figure out what procedures should be required because you don't want to create a burden that an auditor can't achieve. So it is a very difficult question. And there are other audit procedures that are done just as part of the audit that can help auditors find undisclosed transactions, reading board minutes, doing procedures like that. So, you know, ideally auditors remain alert. But are there any other thoughts or input on things that we might want to consider pursuing in a standard in terms of requirements or how a standard might give more information to auditors on things they should be performing outside of, say, reading the minutes or considering information that's obtained in legal confirmations and possibly other confirmations that the auditors receive?
Lynn Turner?
I think that this is one of those areas where at times it's very difficult just to find them. And I can think of some examples this decade where it was hid from board members and certainly hid from auditors, at times maybe even hid from the CFO. So when someone really wants to go hide one of these things, it can get extremely difficult, especially in some of the financial transactions being today, to get done. I think you have to think out of the box, like what Damon mentioned, in terms of just how broad you got to look and where you got to look. It very well may not be where you would expect to find it. At the same time, though, this is one of those areas where the hotline seems to find the problem. And this is where people tend to, quite frankly, spill their guts. So when they see someone inside the company doing these things, they tend to use that hotline to call up. And I think this is one of those areas where if you're really going to go after these hard-to-find things, the auditor really wants to know that hotline is working, that it's really independent, and the opportunity presents itself there for someone inside the company to go ahead and report that. The other thing I think that is important is that in this case, people also consider the ethical standards that companies have and the risks they present, in that many, many companies today have fine ethical guidelines and say we'll do all the right things and yada, yada, yada. But what they don't have is something that says you're in trouble if you know and you don't report. There aren't that many corporations who have in their guidelines, ethical guidelines, a statement that says once a year you have to report that you're in compliance. And you also, though, have to report if you know something isn't right, and to do so can cost you your job. And then on an annual basis, recertify those. And in some of these cases where I've gone in on investigations and found problems, that just doesn't exist. And when you've got that type of system that doesn't work, then the opportunity for someone to hide these goes up significantly. So if I went into a company today as an auditor and I found perhaps their hotline wasn't really truly independent, the audit committee wasn't on top of it, didn't follow up on things, and I couldn't find evidence of that, or I found they had good ethical guidelines but they didn't demand that or lay down the marker that if you know something and you don't report, you can go too, then that to me is a significant risk, because it then tells me automatically that with respect to the type of transactions we're talking here with insiders, related party, the risk that will go undetected for an extended period of time, such it could grow and have a significant impact, has just gone up significantly. And so I would tee it up in the context of does a company have those type of things built into their system? And if they do, I can feel probably much more comfortable about it and adjust my scope accordingly. If they don't have those things in it, then I know that I really don't feel comfortable, and I got to go do and adjust accordingly, you know, given whatever the characteristics of the business are. But this is one place where the hotline and the other stuff really start to come together. And unfortunately, I don't think auditors spend enough time and focus on that in the context of these type of transactions.
Thanks, Lynn. I'll turn to Pat Harnan.
Lynn used the term ethics, and that's my cue. I would echo what Lynn said, that I think most companies do have very good standards for conduct, and they do a good job of trying to communicate that. But I would also add to your comments, Lynn, about the hotline, that the studies we've done of where people go when they observe something happening in their company, it's not to the hotline. If there's a hotline in place, it increases the likelihood that people will come forward, but 97% of reports are going to another member of management, not to the hotline itself. So if an auditor is looking to see how much monitoring of misconduct is happening, and it's also true for reports of financial fraud, they go to another person in management as opposed to the hotline. So it really, there needs to be systems in place to also check where else are reports going. Do we have any mechanism in place if a member of management learns about a problem, because it's probably not coming from the helpline?
Thank you, Pat. That's very helpful. Let's move forward to the next discussion on other relationships. Nick?
SAG members previously noted some concerns over certain transactions, such as round-trip transactions, that might not meet the definition of a related party transaction, but that might pose similar risks. A proposed standard might be able to address those concerns by not restricting the auditor's scope to entities that meet the definition of a related party. For example, the auditor could consider relationships that might be used to achieve a specific accounting result whose form differs from its substance, or to achieve terms that would not be available to independent parties. Similar concerns were discussed in an SEC release which noted that investors may not be able to understand the registrant's reported results without a clear explanation of arrangements and relationships which might not meet the definition of a related party pursuant to GAAP, but that might result in negotiation of terms that are more or less favorable than those available on an arm's length basis from independent third parties. Examples of such relationships might include transactions or relationships with entities managed by former officers, significant customers and suppliers, competitors, or strategic alliances or partnerships. This brings us to our next question. Should a proposed standard require auditors to consider relationships that do not meet the definition of a related party, but that might pose similar risks? Also, what considerations are appropriate, and are there other examples of such relationships that auditors should consider?
Certainly one of the points here is, do we want this the standard right now talks about related party transactions and defines related parties. And one concern is that that restricts to some extent the auditor's thinking in terms of possible types of transactions, while not fitting precisely within the definition of related parties, could nonetheless be still transactions constructed to achieve a certain objective or a certain gain. And the examples put up, I seem to be kind of interesting to me, that potentially transactions with a CFO who's now part of another company, or a CEO who's now at another company, may be types of transactions that could not fall into the category of related party transactions as defined, but we might want auditors to be thinking about transactions that are akin to related party transactions. So I guess the real question is, in the standard, do we want it to be limited to related party transactions, or should there be a provision in there to think about other types of transactions that are of a similar nature? Is that where we're headed with this, Brian?
Absolutely.
Ted White.
I would agree with that. And I think your comment in the next paragraph regarding the substance would be how you would want to define that. I would think you would want reasonably broad scope. You know, obviously being sensitive to a resource allocation issue that is everywhere, but narrowly defining something probably limits some opportunities. But I like the focus on the substance. I think that word is the appropriate way to approach that.
Liz Gantner.
Yeah, I would say that there's always a bigger fish in the pond, you know, and so there's always going to be the critical customer, the critical vendor, the, you know, fill in the blank. And I do think that, as Ted said, that to sort of expand the concept of related party transaction, which therefore could be deemed riskier, that to explain that it doesn't have to be a related party to indeed be riskier, because they might just be able to exercise additional influence in some sort of fashion and gain some sort of benefit that you might not yet be aware of or require an accounting treatment, I think it's very valid.
Thank you, Liz. Bob Dacey.
Thank you. I think it would be relatively important to look at these areas if you became aware of them. So I would put this in the category of be alert and kind of in that same genre of if you run across these things, it should heighten your concerns and you should probably investigate a little bit more, make sure you understand the nature of the transactions and whether or not they actually pose an additional risk or whether they're okay. So I think in that light it ought to be in that vein. But at the same time, I guess, and this kind of circles back to the previous question, is trying to figure out other ways that we can communicate to auditors what some of the areas are that might be indicative of some of these concerns or issues. So when they're charged with being alert, that they have some idea of what these things are they might be thinking about. I believe ISA 550 has some examples of areas where you might pick up the existence of some of these types of transactions or other related party transactions that might be a starting point for you to consider.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. Steve Rafferty?
I tend to believe you're onto something here. My own experience is that there are transactions with parties that either can be influenced, have influence over the entity, have some sort of friendship or kinship relationship that don't meet the definition of the existing definition of a related party, that are truly problematic transactions. And so I think some sort of enhanced attention and guidance to auditors would be helpful to focus on those with additional skepticism. But I would caution you that the bucket might be so big here that we have to be very careful not to just send auditors out on a witch hunt every time somebody's got some kind of relationship. But there is something here that I've seen in my own practice where there are relationships that are problematic, and they have resulted in errors and fraud, but they don't meet the technical definition of a related party.
Liz Gettner?
Yeah, just to further up on that, you know, we started all this with should these be presumed to be fraud risks, and I would want to clarify my comment that typically what I see in these kinds of transactions is they're not a fraud risk, they're just an accounting risk, that there is something unusual about the transaction in that the terms are different or there is a right of return or there is something that creates an accounting phenomenon, not necessarily a fraudulent issue, but perhaps just an error.
And Lynn Turner?
I probably would put something in the standard on these, and I think the substance over form is important, and I think at the end of the day it's more than that, it's their sham transactions is what they really are. And many of these have been fraudulent transactions. We saw with some of the stuff that was done with the Nigerian barges at Enron and Hanover Compressor. We saw it on Elan, the pharmaceutical company out of Ireland, Home Store, Peregrine. So there's been a whole host of these, and they were flat-out fraud. There, some of it was also done with AOL, and the intent to do a was unequivocally fraud. And in a number of cases, it was done in a way to intentionally withhold it from the auditors, which give you a pretty good indication that it was done with fraudulent intent as well. And, you know, when the auditor, in some of those cases, the auditors became aware of it. In some of the cases, they didn't. Perhaps in some of the cases where they didn't, you know, it was just a needle in a haystack you weren't going to find given the way it was done. But nonetheless, I think if they do come to the attention of the auditor, which they did in some instances, like, for example, some of the stuff at Quest, as I recall, did, then I think, you know, if it's one of those things when an auditor looks at it and hair goes up on the back of their neck, the auditor's got to do something about it, and they got to pursue it, and then pursue it with rigor and to conclusion, to understand what the real substance is and whether it is a question, a sham transaction or a real transaction with substance and business purpose. And I think you got to drive the auditors to go do that. If they turn around and see a red flag or something gets raised that says this isn't necessarily what it purports to be, then you got to go find out what it really is. And as an investor, I want the auditors to go do that. I think that's what their job is.
Paul Sobel?
I agree with everything that's been said, and it gets me wondering whether the standard, instead of being a related parties standard, isn't really a kind of an unusual transaction standard, of which related parties may be the most common and frequent example. There are other examples as well, and I'd be concerned that if you stick this in the back end, it may get lost, people thinking it's only about related parties.
And Wayne Collins?
Similar comment to Paul. You know, thinking of a transaction, it could be a one-off transaction with a third party, an independent third party, with whom the company had never done business, reputable company, but wants to enter into a transaction for its own financial benefit, and does it in a way, and structures it in a way that would benefit itself, and the issuer that the auditor is auditing is kind of going along with that transaction. So, you know, looking at the economic substance of the transaction is probably more important than the fact that it's a related party or it's something similar to a related party. So it's more towards looking at the macro fraud possibility versus a related party standard.
Okay. Brian, can you lead us through the last topic this afternoon?
The last topic that we wanted to discuss is management assertions regarding equivalency with arm's length terms. And management might assert that a related party transaction was consummated on terms equivalent to those that prevail in arm's length transactions. Both GAAP and IFRS allow management to make such an assertion. However, neither framework provides direction on how to determine whether the terms and conditions of a related party transaction are equivalent to those that prevail in arm's length exchanges. Existing PCAOB standards note the difficulty in substantiating such assertions, and that such assertions might not be possible except for routine transactions. And the last group of questions that we wanted to talk through, I'll introduce them both at the same time, is first, should a proposed standard include a presumption that an assertion that a material related party transaction was consummated on terms equivalent to those that prevail in an arm's length transaction represent a significant risk? And then second, question 9, what type of evidence could an auditor obtain to support an assertion that a related party transaction was consummated on terms equivalent to those that prevail in an arm's length transaction? I'll open it up to the SAG on both questions. Wayne Collins?
I guess the answer is it depends. I mean, you can have a transaction with a related party that's a company selling widgets and it sells them for $3 and it sells it to everybody else for $3. And, you know, that would not be a significant risk. But you're looking at the pervasiveness of the transaction, how common it is, how out of the ordinary it might be, what the terms are. I think you have to lead that to a judgment call as to whether corroborating that is even possible. So the risk would then be elevated.
Bob? But also, Wayne, with your widget example, should the auditor also ask the question, if that company were not a related party, would they have really engaged in that transaction?
Would the company that bought the widgets enter into the transaction?
I'm just asking you, would the auditor shouldn't the auditor be questioning, if it were not a related party, would the other party have engaged in the transaction with the company you're auditing?
Well, I guess, again, it depends on the volume of the transactions compared to the volume of the other parts of the company's business. And the answer might be yes, they'd have to make that inquiry depending on the volume.
When you said it depends, I guess what you're saying is not all transactions where management is asserting that it was at arm's length to you is a significant risk. Is that?
That's correct.
And I guess one of the things we're trying to get a little bit more feedback is for users of financial statements, when management makes an assertion that a related party transaction was performed on terms that are equivalent to those that are done in an arm's length transaction, how important are those assertions to users of financial statements? Is it something that you would expect the auditor to have applied special attention to during the audit? Is it based on the materiality? Are there different conditions or different types of assertions like that would make it that you would expect more work from an auditor than in other circumstances?
Galen Hansen.
Yeah, Brian, I think under Standard 57, when the client makes that assertion that you're talking about, that the related party transaction is on an arm's length basis, I think there's also a requirement already in that existing standard that has to be auditable. It has to be, the management has to be able to support that assertion. And occasionally we get people that are trying to sneak in the disclosure, something to that effect, and then we inform them, well, you know, this involves a lease. Have you done anything to survey competitive lease rates in the area to support that assertion? And usually we end up seeing those getting dropped. So I'm not sure that that's not already covered in the accounting standards.
Steve Rafferty.
First, a question. You teed that up as a significant risk. I wondered why you didn't tee that up as a significant fraud risk so that we could all disagree with you first before we moved on.
We decided we didn't want you to disagree with us on the last one here.
But I guess I'm sort of opposed to the whole notion of a presumption because that's such a one-size-fits-all deal, and there are a lot of factors that can affect a related party transaction. You know, what system of review and controls does it go through? Who's the related party? How much influence do they have to begin with? The definition of a related party can be, you know, it's broad enough, and the controls within an enterprise could be so broad that I don't know that you could put everybody in the same sort of presumptive bucket here. I think it's another one of those areas where you got to apply judgment.
Greg Jonas.
Steve made a comment earlier today that I agreed with, and that is that we got to be careful about giving the auditor the impression that this is a disclosure-only issue. I think the auditor in related party transactions, once identified, has to reach a conclusion, independent conclusion, about whether the accounting is equivalent to the substance of the transaction and not just the form, regardless of whether management discloses or asserts to the auditor or in the notes to the financials that the transactions are at an arm's length basis. So whatever we do here, I think we have to clearly separate that disclosure is one issue, accounting for substance is always another issue, and the auditor has to worry about both.
Any other comments? I'm sorry. Bob Dacey?
In terms of additional procedures, I do think that if you become aware of it and it's material, that you should do some procedures to gain sufficient appropriate evidence to support that assertion. And if you can't, that's a bit of a problem for the audit, I think. And you have to consider the effect of that on your report.
Thank you, Bob. Any other comments? If not, then I'll turn the meeting back over to Marty.
Thanks, Greg. Well, I'll make a presumption, and I'll presume that everybody has had two full days and is at this point in time a little tired. I've seen some coats going on and some folks walking out the door in the last couple of minutes, as I know it's getting late in the day and people have to travel. So I have the pleasure of wrapping up these 2 days of very, very substantive discussions. I just want to say how profoundly grateful we are at the PCAOB with the extent and the quality of the input that we've received on the matters we've put before the SAG and from the SAG members and observers to this meeting. This meeting has been very, very valuable to us on the standard setting initiatives that we have underway, and we just couldn't be happier with the input and the extent of dialogue that we've received. I also want to briefly comment on go back to the opening comment I made way back when yesterday morning, when I reflected on the fact that I had asked SAG members and observers for input on our process, and I want to ask you again from time to time to share with us whatever input you have on our process, both with respect to standard setting and how we operate the SAG. We want to make sure that this experience is very valuable for you and rewarding to you, and very, very valuable and rewarding to us. This meeting has met that standard from my perspective in being very rewarding to us. But I'm free to take input at any time, email, call me, or any other arrangement with views you have on how we're doing and what we're doing. So please go ahead and continue to do that. We have three SAG meetings planned for next year. As you recall, we have a pretty active standard setting agenda, and you all suggested some other things that maybe should be on that standard setting agenda. So it's good that we've set up three meetings next year and 5 days of meetings to deal with a lot of these things that are on our plate. The next meeting is April 7th and 8th, then July 15th, and October 13th and 14th. So I'm glad we have the 5 days because we have a lot to talk about together. So before I say final thanks and goodbye, I'll just say just open it up for a moment. Does anybody else have anything they want to add in connection with this meeting or any final words? Okay, as I suspected, we're ready to get on our flight, so I'd like to thank you again and wish you, all of those who are traveling, a safe journey, and look forward to seeing you again soon. Thank you.